we have influenced European art, our contribution is essential to what we call European art history today.
Romatopia. Roma tai sintura ceren svato katerlendi utopia. Sarbi shaja e Europa tharate avel.
Hello again, welcome and Lacho Divis to the next episode of the podcast Romatopia, Roma talk about their utopia for Europe. My name is Isabel Rabe and I'm hosting this podcast together with William Biele.
And a big welcome to everyone also from my side. Hello to everybody out there.
In this podcast, we are going to talk to Roma from all over Europe and beyond about their lives, about their experiences and about their utopia. We want to present counter images and counter narratives to oppose stereotypes and prejudices.
In the coming months, we will be talking to a number of noteworthy community members from a varied cross-section of the Romani peoples. I'm really interested in hearing about what being Romani is to other people, because we don't often get a chance to discuss such things. For those who do not know, the Romani peoples are Europe's largest minority. This includes Sinti, Roma, Gitanos, Romanis, and other groups who loosely share a common ancestry and have been present in Europe for well over 600 years. Through linguistic theories, we know they originated in India, traveled through Persia, and were present in the Eastern Roman Empire for some time before dispersing throughout Europe. Their economic and cultural contributions have historically been overlooked. Their history is an integrally interwoven part of European history, which also is often mistaken as one of external exclusion and hardship. Though periods of extreme persecution did make their mark well before the 20th century and the genocide which we suffered during the Second World War. After the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989, Romani peoples have gradually been making themselves more visible on the European scene. And let's welcome our today's guest, the art historian and executive director of the European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture, Timea Junghaus.
Hello, Timea.
Good morning. Hello, Lacho Divas, Isabel. Hello, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
Good to have you here. Timea, we immediately start with a little game. We asked a friend or colleague, who knows, of yours to introduce you with just one sentence. I'm going to read this sentence to you and you have to guess who said this about you. Okay, ready?
Yes.
A passionate lover of beauty with a special soft spot for high heel shoes, which she wears even if she rides her bike to work. I love it, actually.
All right, this will be a colleague. So perhaps this is Anya Mirka.
Yes, yes. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, I really liked it. You and your high heel shoes, and it always looks amazing.
Yes, it's a sweet quote from Anna Mirga Krusenitska. It's really nice. We grew to be so close, so we know everything about each other. In the past 3 years, we worked side by side in Ariak.
Yeah.
Oh, lots and lots of work there. And Timea, can I ask you to start off by describing yourself in one sentence?
Oh, myself. Yes, I am a lover of art, passionate and devoted, self-sacrificing fighter for the recognition of Roma arts and culture.
Yeah, you are.
I have a short CV, maybe not so short because you've done a lot of things. I'd like to read to you and then you could just tell us if it sounds good, if I made any mistakes or if there's anything you'd like to add. Timea Junghaus is an art historian and contemporary art curator. She's the executive director of the Berlin-based European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture since 2017. Timea was research fellow of the Working Group for Critical Theories at the Institute for Art History, Hungarian Academy of Sciences, 2010 to 2017. She's researched and published extensively on the conjunctions of modern and contemporary art with critical theory, with particular reference to issues of cultural difference, colonialism, and minority representation. She's completing her PhD studies in cultural theory at the Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest. Her curatorial works include the first Roma Pavilion at the 52nd Venice Contemporary Art Biennale in 2007, Paradise Lost, the Romani Elders and the Public Intervention for the Unfinished Memorial to the Sinti and Roma Murdered Under the National Socialist Regime in the Frame of the 7th Berlin Biennale in 2012, the Reconceptualizing Roma Resistance Program in Hellerau, Dresden, 2015, and the Goethe Institute Prague in 2016. She was the curator of the Visual Art Section for Roma Archive, Digital Archive of the Roma, from 2015 to 2018. Timea was founding director of Gallery 8, Roma Contemporary Art Space in Budapest from 2013 to 2017. She won many prizes such as the Kairos European Cultural Prize from the Alfred Töpfer Stiftung, the Catalyst Contemporary Art Award of Transit Hungary, and the Otto Pankok Prize awarded by the Roma Foundation of German writer and literary Nobel laureate Günter Grass. Is that correct? And do you want to add anything or make any corrections, including my pronunciation?
Yes, thank you for the question. It's exhausting just to hear this, Stevie. I need to make one correction. That PhD that I started in 2008, I believe that never will be finished unless there will be some quiet time in this life. But it's not on the horizon at the moment.
Okay, all
just
right.
Speeding up.
Timea, for that our listeners get to know you a bit better. Yeah, we are interested in what made you the person you are. So we would like to start to ask you some things about your childhood. What is your most vivid memory of your childhood?
Thank you for the question, Isabel. I am the product of a single mother. My parents divorced when I was 1 year old, actually. And I'm coming from a family that had Sinto circus performers on my father's side, or wouldn't say just circus, because they were also performing music and all kinds of entertainments. But they were traveling until the 60s. And then my mother's side were musicians, Romunglo musicians. Both sides of the family thought that they are very wealthy in a certain way, and they are very privileged. And there is a clash of clans, as we all know, within the Roma context, between Roma and Sinti. And let's admit that both communities believe they are better than the other. So this culminated in the relationship of my parents. Led to a divorce when I was one. So I am the product of a very strict and very disciplined, self-sacrificing mother who has done her best to emphasize the role of education and to make me the person that I am today.
Did you have contact to your Sinto relatives?
Yes, of course, I was on weekends with my father, and unfortunately, I didn't learn much about the culture of the Sinti part of my heritage. Only very cliche, how shall I say, cultural traits that I have seen. But I never asked my father, because I was too young by the time I last met him when I was 10, is that the whole family was boxing. And my father also became a very famous boxer in Hungary. He was national champion, and he was actually traveling to Madrid, Amsterdam, to European championships during socialist Hungary. I mean, nobody could travel during those times except celebrities, party soldiers and sportsmen. So he was a national boxing champion. And funnily enough, he even looked like Rukeli Trollman, the very famous Sinto boxer. Who died during National Socialism, the victim of Nazis. So I never could ask the question if he knew about him or he was even related in a certain way. It was a fascinating family, of course, still living in a caravan in the 13th district of Budapest in the 60s.
And did you grow up in the 8th district in Budapest? Is that right?
Yes. I did grow up in the 8th district, which is to date known as the Harlem of Budapest. It is the district with the largest Roma population. And it was very important for my mother to raise me with the highest possible standards. And this caused a lot of actually funny events in our life. Like, for example, in the home that she had, it was extremely clean and all white. Mm-hmm. You asked me before, what is a memory I have? I have several photographs of myself sitting in a playground in a completely white outfit in the sandbox, with other children, of course, comfortably dressed for the sandbox. But I'm sitting there and even my hands are in this position of, I'm not touching this. And that's at age 3, you know, like, why would you guys do this?
So it's the first experience with the white cube you had.
Yeah, I think so. So it was in my mother's home. Uh-huh. It was in my mother's home. And I think this pose, which was full of fear for her, because I only recently evaluated this, that she must have been so full of fear and existential, financial fear of what happens if she's not in my life and how will I mm-hmm. be fed even? How will I have a home? Mm-hmm. That she was extremely strict with herself and me as well, and also posing and acting and performing stability with her own methodologies of perfect furniture and white dresses and mm-hmm. perfect shoes. Mm-hmm.
And how was school? Did you experience discrimination as a Roma in school?
You also know this, Bill, very well, you know, that their socialism was kind of equalizing and also oppressing mm-hmm. identity debates. But for me, especially, what I brought from home, which is that I have to be amongst the best. And also that I have to differentiate myself with the Roma who do not study and who do not come in immaculate white dresses to school. Uh-huh. So I was programmed by my mother to be an excellent student, and I was unbelievable nerd and a teacher's pet. I really wonder all the time why I wasn't bullied more in school or even beaten by the others. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's so funny because I have a big box at home. Sometimes my friends come over and we open this box and it's full of really funny certificates from age 10. Like, who knows more about the Soviet Union at age 10? Not a district competition, but a Hungarian competition, which means that I went from the school level to the district level to the Budapest level. Then I went to the national level, age 10, and I knew the most about the Soviet Union at age 10.
Wow.
Okay. Well, if I have questions about the Soviet Union, I'm going to come back to you because yeah. you probably remember everything.
Unfortunately not. You know, this culture of pressing us, socialist communist culture of pressing us to memorize. Unfortunately, all this knowledge is now, you know, the passé, it's completely lost. But this, for example, what remained is at age 14, I knew that I want to be an art historian. I want to work with art. And I also knew that I want to work with modern or contemporary art mm-hmm. at like age 14.
Oh, really? That's unusual.
Yeah. How did you get to university? How was it at university? And was it still possible to distinguish yourself or fit in as not being particularly seen as Roma or any discrimination there?
So every year there was a national competition. I'm so sorry that I'm coming out with this story.
No, I like it. I like it. Tell us. We want to hear it. It's good. It's new information.
It's really repulsive. So, but I must admit this. So every year I would win the national competition, or I was amongst the three. Art historian colleagues, even today, there were three or four of us who were always amongst the three winners of the national art historian competitions for high school students. But in my high school students, I had a quite big crisis, actually, in my high school years, because these were the years when I had to define myself. And I also had to kind of come to terms with my skin color, which was much darker than my mother's. I had to come to terms to all the discrimination and calling out my gypsiness during my childhood and during my years of education, which has happened against the fact that I was a nerd. Mm-hmm. At the end, I was just a gypsy girl. So I had to rebel against my mother. I had to rebel against the system of the education system I was in. And I didn't prepare right before the university. That was the only year that I didn't win the competition. I was actually, I think, flirting with one of the other competitors. So I couldn't win in the most important year, when the winning of this competition would have meant that I get into university automatically. Mm-hmm. And I had to take the entrance exam and study the complete literature biography that was given for the entrance exam. And I had to write the exam. And of course, in the rebel mode, during the oral exam, I even had the topic of Dadaism, amongst all the others, with like antique architecture, Gothic altars. You know, I was with Dadaism in the oral exam. But I managed to get in, and then university started. To answer your question, Bill, it took me 14 years to finish my art history education, mm-hmm. and it was miserable.
Oh.
Yes, it was completely miserable and difficult for me. I didn't know how to keep up and didn't know how to write and speak the language of this old intellectual heritage that many of my fellow students had, bringing it from their families. Mm-hmm. So I had a completely different career during my university years. I don't know if you guys know this. This is another embarrassing story, actually. I was a sales agent for Yellow Pages. Do you know what Yellow Pages is?
What's embarrassing about that? I don't see any problem with that.
Yeah, I don't think people know what Yellow Pages is.
But no, because we have the internet now, that's yeah. why.
So it was a book of businesses, mm-hmm. and you could sell advertisements in it, and that's what people would use to contact businesses when they were in need. And I started selling that, and I was extremely successful in that. I also had my first baby, so I basically had to find a job because my husband was also studying at that time. So one of us had to work, and I made an extremely successful career as a sales representative in an American firm, actually Verizon's Hungarian subsidiary. And in this American firm, of course, there was a policy of training and promoting success. So right away, half year later, I was a key account, getting the biggest accounts of this Yellow Pages company. And after being a key account, I was sent to Dallas, the USA, for a training on a leadership training. And I became the trainer of the company. Mm-hmm. And after 2 years, I became the HR director of the Hungarian subsidiary, with like having 180 employees.
Wow.
It was a very fast career. I really enjoyed it. Actually, to date, I haven't made that much money when I left that position. But I had to leave because my mom came to my office and packed up my office and told me I have to finish university.
Oh, really?
Okay.
And I think she was right. Mm-hmm. Well, she's always right.
It's really amazing. You said when you were 14, you decided to become an art historian. Why? What is your connection to art? What was your first encounter with the arts?
I had an excellent teacher in arts, who was our teacher already from my age 10. And she also ran an after-school activity, which was basically going through all kinds of art techniques, from photography to engravings and even etching to painting. She was a role model in the sense that she was strict and educating, but at the same time allowed space for self-expression and welcomed creativity in many ways. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed her classes, and then she was the one enrolling me to a competition about art. Mm-hmm. My mom especially liked this. She always had a laic passion for art, even if she understands it in a limited way for beauty. And she loves kitsch, for example. My mom mm-hmm. loves kitsch. I also love kitsch too.
Mm-hmm. I found a very nice quote by you. It goes, "I became an art historian because I always found that art is an important strategy in my own self-recovery." Is that still working?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's where I heal.
Mm-hmm.
That is where my meditation takes place. Creativity is where I play and where I find a connection. So for me, it's an extremely important part of my life. I don't go and see art sometimes. I really live art in my everyday practice.
Mm. You say that this is really, that art is so important for you in your everyday practice. How did you experience the pandemic? I mean, it, of course, it's distancing to friends, colleagues, family, but also to the arts. How was it for you? How did you experience the last months?
Yes, this is exactly what I wanted to say, actually, Isabel, that I'm very lucky because right before the strict lockdown, I have absorbed so much art. I had a weekend in Berlin when I saw all the exhibitions. I went to see the Warburg exhibition and spent really like a whole day on the panels.
Mm-hmm.
By accident, I managed to see Kirya Petrenko's last concert before the shutdown
mm-hmm.
in the Philharmonie.
Mm-hmm.
In this really strange setting with the masks and, I don't know, social distancing between the chairs. And then even in December with ERIAC, we managed to have the Diaspora Europe program,
mm-hmm.
which gave the team the opportunity to experience being with the artist and curating music. It will be only live streamed,
mm-hmm.
but this gave me the opportunity to absorb enough art so that I can make it for a few weeks. And now I just go from, how shall I say, artwork to artwork. So I use every opportunity. For example, I never understood, and I don't know if you guys know this, but I never understood private collections. I was really critical with people who accumulated a grand private collection and isolated it from social and public, social events and public view. So I now understand a little bit better the role of the salon. So I get together with musician friends on a very small circle, just two of us or three of us together, work together anyway, and I enjoy art that way.
Mm.
But it's extremely difficult, yes.
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah, because you used to do a lot of traveling and you moved to Berlin a few years ago. So yeah, I guess you can't do that very much now with the pandemic and the lockdown. But given the traveling and all of the different work that you do, can I ask you, where do you feel at home?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, Bill. I listened to, it's really interesting how none of our colleagues could really give you a very, very simple answer to this question. I really enjoy this part of your series. So, you know, my children are in Budapest. We have a home that is the family home. So certainly Budapest is very important to me. And I am such a patriot. You know, the Orban regime is really trying to take this away from those who are not into the populist
yep.
Discourse. They take my patriotism away from me in a certain way. But I'm a patriot. I love this city. I cannot live without the view of the Danube for too long. I know this city in and out, and I know every single artwork that's in this city. I have to think sometimes. This is certainly a home for me. And Berlin has given me so much. And the work with ERIAC is so emotional and so fantastic that I certainly belong there. So my heart is completely torn between these two places. And now my life is torn between these two places too. Even during the pandemic, I think I'm one of the last persons who must travel. I have a very good reason. My job is there and my children are here and no authorities can overcome this conflict.
Mm.
I am traveling every second week between Berlin and Budapest.
Ah, really?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's nice to hear you have a home in Budapest. You feel at home in Berlin. So it's not like you're living somewhere where you don't feel at home. You have places where you feel at home, basically.
Yeah, could not choose at the moment.
Okay. Well, no one's asking you to rank or choose. we just want to hear your opinion and how you do it.
It would be nice to settle at a certain point, wouldn't it, Bill? I don't know.
Yes, 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 yes. I ask or I go through these kinds of phases where I think to myself, yes, it would be nice to choose one place and just be there forever. And then things change and I get fed up and I'm very happy to move along. So things change. Yes. Yeah, I feel at home where I am. I feel I was very much at home in different places that I lived, a few places where I'm glad I'm not there anymore as well. So yeah, it changes over time. But there's one thing about feeling, yeah, not feeling welcome, feeling like you don't belong somewhere or places where you can fit in and feel at home. But maybe, yeah, there's different kinds of homes. Maybe it's not like a home where you always have to go back to the exact same place. There's different kinds of homes.
Yes, and also I feel a lot of our Roma colleagues, fellow travelers feel the same way. I have a bag in Berlin, and that bag enables me to get on the road anytime, mm-hmm. to be honest. And I often feel when I'm pulling this luggage that I don't need anything else. Like I feel that, you know, perhaps the subversion of this life is completely necessary. We can just get on the road and be on the road forever. Like we don't have to choose and pick and arrive.
Yeah. I understand. It's if when you have to move and you have to put all your things in boxes, do you really need to take all this stuff with you? Maybe it's easier to just take a small suitcase and throw everything else away and forget about it. But then a couple of weeks later, I miss some things that I've accumulated. So, yeah, I don't know that I need everything that I have and that I need to take it with me everywhere I go either. And sometimes it's just good to be in a different place. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of different places, so you're in Berlin right now?
I'm in Budapest. I'm sitting in Budapest. I just arrived last Friday.
What's the situation now, if I may? I'll ask you perhaps a big, hard, general question, but you can answer any way you like, of course. What's the situation with Roma now in Budapest today? How are they taking it with the pandemic or anything you've seen personally, or maybe things that you see in the news that maybe are not making it out of Hungary?
There is no Budapest specific news. I can tell you that the pandemic has a lot of victims. It's taken too many victims in Hungary because of the situation of the healthcare system. And this healthcare system is basically non-existent in rural Hungary. And I also know that in the very beginning of the pandemic, the community was already scapegoated and isolated. Really shameful events of shaming of the community has happened. A community which has limited water access, of course, it is struggling with financial disadvantage and had an extremely difficult time adjusting to the hygiene requirements without any support of the public authorities. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you of shameful stories, for example, the lunch shipments to the schools in isolated communities would be thrown to the side of the road in front of a village because the food shipper wouldn't want to drive into the community. Mm-hmm. Or humanitarian packages would arrive to the community, which the community would find humiliating, with like potatoes and soap, while the community specifically would ask for masks and proper hand sanitizing products. So it's, you know, this kind of scapegoating, disinformation in the news is very relevant in the Hungarian context. And to reflect a little bit on the Roma intellectual community, there isn't much done at the moment by the Roma politics. Roma politics in Hungary is basically non-existent.
Is it non-existent because people are afraid to speak out, or they've left, or they're just not meeting because of the, I don't know, why is it non-existent? What's happened exactly for that?
The real civil rights activism of the great leaders such as Aladár Horváth, Jenő Zsikó, Ágnes Daróczi was limited. The facilities and the infrastructure was taken away by the Orbán government. And the Roma leaders who are in the court of Orbán are have nothing to do with the community, or when they do, this is a very straight out compromised situation by Orbán and a very structured and efficient way of mobilizing EU funds, you know, without any improvement in the communities.
Yeah. I was just wondering from the point of view, like since the pandemic, I think in a lot of different countries, a lot of different places, there are so many more online events. People are talking, political art, discussions, all kinds of different events taking place. And I'm just wondering, I don't know, do Roma in Hungary not have access to the internet, or do these Roma leaders, they're not tech savvy, they can't gather people on an internet forum, or is that, I don't know, maybe that's an irrelevant question, but I'm wondering why it's so quiet when in so many other places it seems like there's more activity going on.
Yes, there isn't an issue with creativity. So you still see the artists, the Hungarian artists online, but what you don't see is Hungarian political leaders speaking to the community online any longer. I think the left is silent at the moment, and not just in the Roma context, to be honest.
Okay. Mm.
And then also a big loss is that the CEU, the Central European University, had to leave Budapest for Vienna.
Central European University, CEU, is a private research university accredited in Austria, Hungary, and the United States, with campuses in Vienna and Budapest. Part of the university's mission is the promotion of open societies as a result of its close association with the Open Society Foundations and George Soros. On December 3rd, 2018, CEU announced it would cease operations in Budapest and relocate to Vienna after the Hungarian government refused to sign an agreement allowing the university to continue operations in Hungary. Supporting Roma and the development of Romani studies at CEU is a part of the university's mission. The loss of the university in Budapest is therefore also a great loss for the Roma in the region.
I think this is also a big loss for the city, isn't it?
It's a devastating loss for the city. Mm. And to be honest, the Hungarian critical intellectual sphere has left Hungary. I am so devastated when I think about our little country's future. It is impossible to create real subversive politics without this massive group, this mass of critical intellectuals who are now living in Berlin and in London and in the US or shaping other countries' politics for democracy.
Timia, let's talk about your work. You're a distinguished curator and art historian. We're going to talk about your curatorial work later and, of course, also about your work for the European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture. But before, let's talk a bit about your academic work. As a researcher, you were actually the first or one of the first to work on the representation of Roma in art history. I've seen some of your lectures on this topic and read some of your texts. It's really extremely interesting, and I think it's an exciting topic to share with our listeners. So my first question, what are the most important things to know about the representation of Roma in art history, and what can we learn from it?
This is a gigantic question.
Yes, I know.
And I also have to be very careful because there is such little information I can transfer. And when we say art history, how could I even make the impression that I know art history of, you know, several centuries, starting from the 9th to the 15th, and then when Roma first appeared, and then going on to modernity, for example. Mm. Perhaps two important events I can call attention to. And this is, for example, around 1427, when there is written sources of Roma appearing in Saint-Denis, and the description the written manuscripts and descriptions about these foreign groups of Roma, which is now proven by several academics and historians that these texts are speaking of the Roma. We find in art history several depictions of the groups that the text, the manuscripts also describe. Mm-hmm. And these depictions are showing women with a flat head guard, which is then, and also with a cape, which is tied on the shoulder. The flat head guard is usually covered with additional layers of clothing, and it's very recognizable. The cape, for example, on the men usually has stripes. And in paintings, for example, these people who are described appear very dark-skinned, mm-hmm. and very dark-haired, and also heavily jeweled with different body jewelry. So why I'm saying these people and not us Roma is these, we cannot make any connection between actual living Roma people and the depiction of these exotic groups of Roma people arriving to different city gates. Mm-hmm. From this point on, Roma appear in art history already in the Northern Renaissance, whenever artists are showing the multiculturality of their era. And Roma also appear in different storylines that are believed to be connected to their history. And again, believed to be connected is a very important term here, mm-hmm. because what happens is, for example, the same women with the cape and the head guard appear with the dark skin, appear in stories, for example, of little Moses being put on the water in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And this is because of the misunderstanding that the gypsies, the Roma, came from Egypt. Mm-hmm, these people came from Egypt. So a lot of the wear and the description is coherent with the depiction of the Egyptians, for example. Whenever artists would like to depict the exotic, the heathen, the non-Christian, or those who do not belong to us, they happen to be sometimes of the group of Roma. For example, on Bruegel's paintings, mm-hmm. or for example, on Roger van der Weyden's painting, the heathen, and those who do not belong to the otherwise white community are not black people, but Roma, and we can identify them by their wear, mm-hmm. and by their body position, and by their face jewelries. Mm-hmm. And then I make a big jump because in the coming centuries, we basically can identify Roma by the same wear and also matching the manuscripts with the depictions. And this is an investigation job. It's a lot of fun, really. Mm. But then in the 19th century, what is extremely interesting is that in the areas, in the territories, geographies of Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe, where the artists are not able to travel, like the Western artists, to Tahiti or to Aix-en-Provence or to real faraway exotic islands or be connected to African inspirations, they travel to their closest colonies. And these colonies, for example, for the Hungarian artists, are Szolnok, which is 70 kilometers from Budapest, where a large Roma settlement is. Yeah. And the same happens with the Austrian artists, and the same, I mean, they don't go to Szolnok, they go to their closest Roma settlement to find their exotic. And this is where they find their models. We often see that these models are reused and recirculated in art of Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. And many of the models actually are influencing not just the art of Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe, but also the art of Europe, mm-hmm. the art history as we know, as European art history.
Do you think the depictions of the Roma body in art history are a result of, I don't know, French and English and Spanish colonialism and how these bodies were represented in their art, and then it was kind of copied and transmitted in Central Europe by visiting Roma colonies, basically internal colonies? Or are you saying that the depiction of the Roma was first and that influenced the colonialism. I'm not sure if I maybe I missed some subtlety there, but I'm interested in this parallel to the sexualized colonized body.
Yeah. Well, my position is extremely difficult, Bill, because let's admit there aren't too many art historians who are devoted to this research. So how do you make conclusions if you do not have the opportunity for a real consilium to check your theories and to really have a very rigorous argument which is tested by other colleagues. So I would like to be very careful and simply say, let's admit one of the largest European colonies are actually an internal colony, the Roma people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is unavoidable that in the past, I would say, millennium that we have spent in the European continent, we have influenced European art as models, as shapers of European art history, as being the ultimate artists. You know, as Ethel Brooks often says, being the performers, the portrait painters on the road, the goldsmiths, the silversmiths, the sculptors, taking culture from one location to the next, information, culture, art, taking it and connecting it with other communities. So our contribution is essential to what we call European art history today.
Mm-hmm. And you were also, I find this very interesting, working on, you mentioned it before, the role of the models. And I know that you were researching on giving back names to these models, right?
Yes, I think an exhibition which is actually told from the perspective from the model would be truly enlightening. For example, I mentioned here Fenella Lavelle. Mm-hmm. And Fenella Lavelle had such an important influence onto European art as being the model of Rodin, and also being given by Rodin to Ripu Rónai, the Hungarian painter who was connected to European modernism and French, has been on the Paris Salon several times. It's very interesting because even biographies of these artists mention her as an American gypsy who was a muse, a natural-born muse, and who could play the guitar, but was of immense beauty. But I recently discovered that she's a Czech Romney, Bill. You'll be happy about it. She's a Czech Romney who has traveled. And yes, she became a famous singer and a performer, and her art led her to be recognized by these male artists who have then, you know, asked her to be their muse and their inspiration.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you should do this exhibition, actually.
Yeah, I would love to one
day. Yes, you have to. Actually, you did a lot of work on postcolonial theories. I refer to Edward Said's theory of Orientalism and Othering.
The term othering describes the use of distancing and differentiation from distinct groups in order to affirm one's own normality. The concept of othering originated in the context of postcolonial theory and was mainly coined by authors such as the literary critic and political activist Edward Said and literary theorist and feminist critique Gayatri Spivak. Othering is a permanent act of demarcation, categorization, and ultimately a distinction between an us and them.
As you said before, Roma are kind of Europe's black people. So what can you tell us about the colonial fantasies of the majority society about Roma people?
When we speak about, for example, the depiction of Roma in European art history, or how Roma art is constructed, it's very important that we are facing an immense tradition, the tradition that is created without Roma input, which is how the non-Roma imagine the Roma subjectivity. This is really a gigantic challenge. When I, in the beginning, said we have to be very careful if we say, you know, about Roger van der Weyden painting, we see the Saint Magdalene in the head guard that is depicted usually with Roma. We cannot say that here we see a Roma woman. Because unfortunately, most probably, this iconography refers to a hidden woman in general. And Roma are necessary already in the 15th century. They are necessary so that the majority can distinguish and imagine itself.
Yeah.
And if you think about this, this is in 1427, 1490, let's say, the Roger van der Weyden painting. So already these differentiations and these discriminations were existing in the 16th century, 15th and 16th century Europe. We are dealing with such an immense heritage of differentiation and also exoticization that when we speak of changing stereotypes, a decade, Roma decade for changing stereotypes, I mean, I get the giggles from this, to be honest.
Yeah. Yes, and again, this exoticization and romanticization of the Roma tells much more about the majority of society than about Roma themselves.
Tamea, you said that the European population, I really like this one quote, I'm just repeating it, that the European population needed the Roma to distinguish and imagine itself. I just wanted to bring that point out because I think it's still relevant today and it's part of our history, but it's also maybe relevant to contemporary art, contemporary Roma art. I've seen this come out in different ways, maybe not expressed exactly the same way, but the idea of without the other, you can't, we can't be us if we don't have the other, and how central that is to the concept of understanding the concept of the gypsy versus the concept of the Roma, because the other isn't necessarily Roma, as you were describing.
Yes, so the idea of the gypsy versus the white majority is very much of, you know, the Said fundamental thesis, you know, how the West needed the other to versus itself. It is a very natural dynamics that we learn from Orientalism. But I need to address here, based on Isabel's question, I need to address here another very important phenomena. And this is very relevant to our present day. And this is how, in the case of the Roma, what happens with the depictions of Roma in art history, and also the contributions of Roma in this whole othering process and fighting against othering primarily, is that we are present and some of our history and some of our contribution is actually also taken by this kind of post-colonial power game or decolonial power game. Many of the Roma images in art history, for example, are identified currently as images of Black people. And yes, we can engage in the discussion that we think of ourselves as the Black people of Europe, Cali, Europa. This is very much present in the Roma context that we are Black as well. But this is not Afro-European heritage. This is the Roma minority, the largest European colony, as I mentioned before, impacting European art history. So the reclaiming process is still ahead of us. And we need art historians, art theoreticians, we need artists who will really work on getting into the discussions, the scientific discussions of art history.
When did this reclaiming movement or this, let's say, Roma cultural movement and modern Roma art start? This reclaiming as you describe it? When do you first see that?
I see it connected, and you can challenge me on this, Bill and Isabel, because I see it very much connected to the first Romani Congress. And also in the late 60s in Hungary, there was János Balázs, who was a very, very important celebrity. With all the wrong reasons and all the romanticizations and exoticizations that we can imagine, described as a lonely genius, unpaired on the earth, and this old hermit who was discovered in the countryside. So, you know, this romantic idea of the lonely genius, it's such a cliche, and yet it was so popular in late 60s Hungary that he could really become a celebrity, like he was in women's magazines covers and he was celebrated as a real icon. And that gave a huge, huge wave of popularity for the creative production in Hungary.
Would you consider that like the beginning of considering Roma interventions and Roma art as a counterculture? Because often people consider Roma art as a understanding it as a kind of counterculture. And do you think it started really then, or?
I wouldn't say that was counterculture. That was that was still theorized as naive art.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, just because I identify a certain beginning, as I said, it doesn't mean anything. There are so many other beginning points that we can start from. There was, for example, a Romanian wood carver who wanted to found a museum in 1939. Vinceler Horvath. So I think that's also an interesting story. But what is certainly a very important starting point we can depend on is the first Romani Congress, which claimed that Roma authorship needs to be recognized. Mm-hmm. And they primarily thought of the writers themselves, who were still published under like other names. But at that certain point, you know, Roma were still represented by folklorists, anthropologists, Wunderkammer owners, mm-hmm. Yeah. Ethnographers. So this was an extremely important step that really fertilized the creative industries in all our countries.
The first World Romani Congress took place on the 8th of April 1971 near London. It was attended by 23 representatives from 9 nations: Czechoslovakia, Finland, Norway, France, Great Britain, Germany, Hungary, Ireland, Spain, and Yugoslavia. 5 sub-commissions were created to examine social affairs, education, war crimes, language, and culture. At the Congress, the Roma flag as well as the Roma anthem Jelem Jelem were introduced as symbols of the international Roma community. There have been 9 international Roma Congresses so far. Every year on April 8th, Roma communities around the world celebrate International Roma Day, not only to raise awareness of the demands for political, legal and social justice, but also to celebrate Roma pride and Romani Pen.
It's really interesting that you mentioned the first Roma World Congress, that such a political emancipation movement, civil rights movement, is completely interwoven from the very beginning with this cultural movement. So that again tells about the power of the arts.
Absolutely. But let's admit also that the first Romani Congress came together as a political congress. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, during those years, for example, Agnes Daróczi was winning, or amongst the winners, of the Hungarian Kimi Tud, which is like the X Factor of today.
Okay. Mm.
With her talent of saying poems, mm. primarily Romani poems, by the way. Károly Bari, who was also there as a politician, was writing poems. Thomas Acton was a young professor. It wasn't simply a political congress. It was a vibrant exchange of extremely creative people, writers, artists, performers, musicians. So it's really the Midnight Children conference of the Roma Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So with contemporary Roma art, what means Roma art for you personally?
Yes. Contemporary Roma art is a term that was not really used before the 90s. Actually, maybe before the 2000s. I think that what happened in the 2000s is that we started this critical turn. A lot of the next generation, after the first Roma Congress, the next generation was educated in critical theories. And I don't refer here only to postcolonial theory, but also the theories of feminist studies and feminist theory and trauma studies, the idea of decoloniality or working with other critical studies such as critical anthropology. These all appeared in the Roma discourse. And I think that this critical theoretical discourse has transformed the art scene, which was until that point considered self-trained and autodidact and had labels such as naive and barbarian and art brute and outsider art in the best case. So when we started ourselves theorizing art produced by Roma intellectuals, that is when Roma contemporary art was born. And this is early 2000s, and the culmination of this shift, this paradigmatic shift, is actually the first Roma Pavilion. I'm always so grateful that I live during these years and these times, because this transformation is really amazing in my life, witnessing this together with the artists.
Yeah, you curated the first Roma Pavilion, the Paradise Lost Pavilion, in 2007. And now at the last Biennale in 2019, the European Roma Institute initiated the Future Roma exhibition curated by Daniel Baker, who was actually our very first guest in this podcast. So you witnessed all this time and the development. What has changed for Romani arts and artists in the meantime, in the last 12 years?
What has changed is a very, very important change. The notion of Roma contemporary art is accepted. It is part of the art discourse. It's possible and imaginable that Roma artists are not outside of the artistic canon, but an integral part of it. Art itself is in crisis because of its institutions at the moment. And there is space, there is potential inclusion coming in the next years. And I am fearing more that we don't have enough people to fill the spaces, that we don't receive enough inclusion.
Is there, you think, Roma art can offer resistance. Did we reach the critical mass regarding number of Romani artists? Or what does Romani art need to really develop its resistance and its power?
I think that Roma art is not only for me, but for the for the whole community, is a source of inspiration and hope. It is very fundamental for us to find ourselves in positions, for us Roma, to find ourselves in positions when we need examples and models of resilience and survival. And art, for example, in our performances, in our traditions, in our art forms, are really important proofs that this resilience is with us for centuries now. What I also find is the artists are able to speak so clearly of the aspirations and the potential of our community, and also touch upon the taboos, which the community and, let's admit, political advocacy could never really do so properly and precisely. So I'm always grateful for the artists for these. I think that going forward, art is actually the most substantial strategy in the Roma context.
Do you have a favorite Romani artist?
Depends if you're asking, you know, for a graphic artist. Do I have a favorite painter? Do I have a favorite woman artist? I could I could give you many favorites. Almost everyone I can also put a label on, so we're going to sit here forever.
Okay, no problem. No.
Why that person is my favorite in exactly which way.
Sure. Okay. If someone's never been involved with contemporary art, how should they get started? Do you have any recommendations on where someone could get started?
where someone could get started. Yes, I believe we have the ERIAC space has regular exhibitions and also an archive of all the previous exhibitions. And we have spent the past 3 years on exhibiting the most well-known artists. And you previously asked, do we have enough new talent and upcoming artists and enough potential. I think that ERIAC also needs to consider how to find upcoming talent. And I used to really enjoy doing this, and I had a lot of capacity for this in my previous years as a curator, finding new talent. Mm-hmm. And I hardly have any time for this. I'm hoping some researchers, young researchers and curators will find the same passion that I had in the beginning of my career. And we will learn that there's artists of Roma origin coming out of universities, fine arts institutions every day.
Mm. And someone who is looking at the Roma arts, where would they start? Who should I look at? Where do I start if I want to learn about this type of art?
I wanted to say two examples. One was the ERIAC space and ERIAC's archive, which is also available on the website. And the other very good location is the Roma Archive website, where we also have a list of artists and where you can actually learn about previous projects, about the art history and the image of the Roma in art history. You can also learn artistic oeuvres and you can have like a monographic search. So that's where you would start your research. And then you would learn that there is no permanent space where you could walk in and actually study Roma arts, which is really, I mean, astonishing in today's Europe, that we don't have a museum where you can study the history and the art and the contribution of European Roma. I think this is kind of outrageous, actually.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to pin you down on naming an artist, but I see I'm not going to be successful at doing that. But the fact that there is a list, if our listeners are listening and they want to know about, there is a list of artists on the ERIAC website, and you can look them up and then you can look at their work and you can get started there. So I just want to make that clear to everybody. Okay.
You know, if I really have to name some of the leaders of the Roma art scene, I will certainly say that some of the artists who are still mentoring the next generations, some of the artists who were exhibiting in the first Roma pavilion, Delaine Lebas, Daniel Baker, yeah. I would say André Rach, I would mention here, also Damien Lebas, who has passed away, but his art is inspiring today. I will mention from their mentorship, we see a second generation of artists who are working with more multimedia technology. I really like the art of Roland Korponovich. We have new women artists, Malgorzata Mirgatas, Emilia Rigova, and we have artists who would never want to be mentioned in the Roma context, but I have to mention them, amazing graphic artist Robert Gabri. And I love the art of, Daniel Turner. So I could continue forever, which is very unfair, because let's admit there's hundreds of Roma artists in today's European scene. And we always say this, most of the Central and Eastern European state collections are archiving over 10,000 Roma artworks, and none of them are visible. So someone who actually wants to learn about this has a very, very difficult task, and that's shameful.
Yes, yes. Thank you for saying that. Art is a tool of knowledge production, a tool of resistance, a tool of empowerment. I wanted to ask you, with respect to this, how have you seen Roma communities react to contemporary Roma art? And I'm asking specifically because Ethel spoke with us in the frame of the Future Roma exhibition that was at the Venice Biennale in 2019, initiated by ERIAC. You organized the visit of members of the Roma community to come and see the show. What were their reactions?
First of all, we had so much fun on this trip. Diana Pavlovich is a very inspiring leader. And the Italian Roma community adores her in every way possible. Mm-hmm. So I must say that the event was slightly hijacked by Diana's role as a celebrity leader. But the community was so interested, engaged, and respectful towards the art that immediately we had, I think, 180 live broadcasts from their iPhones going towards the other community members. There was a very torturous contemporary art dance by a Swiss, you guys will need to help me out, by a Swiss artist, Roma Artist Company.
Roma Jam Session?
Roma Jam Session, thank you. So we had, I think it was a 45-minute minimalist art, a robotic futu performance. It was hard for me to comprehend, and with all the references that I know from art history, and also with all my nerdiness. And the community was disciplined and completely engaged, filming and photographing and loving it and adoring them at the end of it. It was touching and so emotional that we are together in a way that is challenging us at the same time and educating. And there were many generations present at the same time. It was us, many of the Ariaca events, truly touching and very much inspiring, yes.
Yeah, thanks for telling us about that. I think it's time for us to take a little break, talk about our next little game or our memory piece. We ask our guests to bring a virtual gift. And if you could tell us a little bit about why and what you've chosen for us. Usually these memory pieces, they should be an object, an item that tells an important biographical anecdote or represents a central idea in the life of our guests. So Timea, what's our present?
I brought you a handmade catalog from 1973 at an exhibition of Tamás Béli. He was very young then, and he just returned from the Dutch Royal Academy, where he was taught as a painter. And he said, I could have stayed, but I'm coming back because my mission is here in this country. He was an educated painter who then went to Tiszadob and painted the largest panneau of Central Europe, a 42 square meter wall painting. Mm-hmm. And this Tiszadob Castle was actually an orphanage where Hungary isolated primarily the Roma children who weren't going to be adopted by the white parents. So they were supposed to grow up here. And in this orphanage, there was a painting about the birth and the history of Roma people. So these young Roma orphans were having their breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day in front of this gorgeous panel. And he created an exhibition. He most probably couldn't print a catalog for his exhibition, so he hand wrote it and he made photographs. And I received this little booklet from his follower and student, István Szent Andrássy, with many other similar treasures. And I wish I could show it to you now because it's absolutely beautiful.
Wow, that's a nice present. André Raj once introduced me to the work of Tamás Béli. It's really impressing. Thanks a lot. That's a nice present. Thanks.
Yes, very nice. Thank you.
We put it on our virtual gift shelf.
Timea, I'd like to talk a little bit about Ariac, or maybe get you to talk a little bit about Ariac. So for our listeners, you know, so they know, in June 2017, there was an important historic moment for the Roma cultural movement. The European Institute for Arts and Culture, Ariac, was founded. It's based in Berlin. And you, Timea, you're the executive director. Ariac is an international platform for European Roma culture and art, for self-representation and knowledge production. Can you tell us a little bit about the work, a little bit about the institution of Ariac, and a little bit about the aims and some specific examples of the work that's been done?
Yes. Also, you are also on the Alliance for Ariac, Bill,
yes.
So you know very well the history.
But I will. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I am trying to play the role of the radio announcer so that You play a very important role, and I think our listeners would like to hear it from you more than they would like to hear it from me. But okay. I'm happy to fill in anything, and thank you for mentioning that, because I'm not hiding anything either. Okay.
Very good. So I start with the history. The 2017 launching of the European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture is actually the crown of very diligent and difficult, also straining work of the Alliance for the European Roma Institute. The European Roma intellectual and cultural movement has fought over four decades for an independent state for the recognition of Roma arts and culture. And the Alliance did the same, built on this cultural movement, but fought for 4 years and also advocated and represented this important cause in front of politicians, ambassadors, and the Council of Europe and open society foundations to achieve the founding moment. So imagine that these 17 intellectuals use their own resources and advocate and work voluntarily for 4 years just to achieve this institute. So from my position, 4 decades of Roma cultural movement, hundreds of Roma intellectuals, the struggling community's desire, the 4 years of the Alliance members in this one institute, and the trust of the Council of Europe, and all the decades of work of the Open Society Foundations, and the devotion of Mr. Soros himself. Mm. So leading this institute is extremely humbling, and a gigantic responsibility, and a job in which you wake up every single morning focusing on how you can excel and thrive and serve. So ERIAC was established in 2017, and since 2017, we had over 230 events. This puts an important event, an international conference, an exhibition, you know, an opening onto the activity map of this organization. Almost every week we have two of these events. It's extremely active and demanding work. And of course, this is not ERIAC's work. ERIAC's just an office in Berlin that receives the contribution of the members. It's a membership-based organization. And the association's members are actually at the moment 147 members, individuals and organizations that are continuously contributing to the mission and daily work of ERIAC.
Yes, and I would like to add, and you can correct me, there are 4 thematic sections: arts and culture, knowledge production, history and commemoration, and media. And a new branch office was recently opened in Belgrade as well. Mm. Is that correct?
Yes. We have the 4 thematic sections. We have a cross section, which is linguistics, and we are actually about to publish the first language book for Romani education. And yes, we finished the building of a Belgrade office, which you would never think you could actually build an office through Zoom conferencing, but it's possible. Because we built it during last year, during the shutdown. And the launching event didn't take place yet, so we cannot say it's opened, but it is there.
Yeah. It's there, great.
But as soon as it's possible to gather, we shall have a grand opening of a beautiful art space in Belgrade.
Do you want to give us some specific examples of your work, like Roma Mama or others you want to highlight?
I think that in ERIAC's history, some of the most important milestones are appearing as a commissioner at the Venice Biennale, and also the Futuroma exhibition of Daniel Baker, and the exhibited 9 artists was a true success. And then I would mention the Barva Lippe University, which is a public education program that we are conducting online, but it is a very conscious selection of the strongest Roma academics, highest scholarship, interrogated by opponents, and a very rigorous academic discussion.
Yeah, I was very impressed by the series of those discussions and the selection of the subjects as well, from linguistics to history to political movements, all of that. I think that's some excellent resource. And if anyone hasn't listened to that, it's still available for people to click on and listen to those lectures. Is that something that is going to continue on a regular basis, or is it, I don't know, planned for, I know, certain seasons, like a university semester, or how is that developing?
The Barbara Lippe lectures will continue also this year in the same format, because the format is complemented by even academic institutions. And what happened to the Barbara Lippe lecture series is now academic institutions are reaching out to ERIAC to request cooperations or request access to the Barbara Lippe lectures. And this happens to ERIAC often, that we do not prepare for the projected image of success and size that we project into the ether. And now we are having discussions with three academic institutions about how to prepare to use this in seminars and in online education methodologies together with students. What are the materials that the students will need? But we certainly consider and continue to prepare the lectures as they were before, and there will be other forms of using them for education purposes. I would also mention here the Roma MoMA. The Roma MoMA is, the word comes from, of course, imagining a Roma Museum for Modern Art. And this is a think tank together with the Off Biennale, together with several amazing art historians and critics who are on a think tank, and together with whom we decided to simply start performing Roma MoMA as it would exist. It started with theorizing what this Roma MoMA would do. And we have texts from MUSEM curator Giulia Ferloni, curator and current Moscow cultural attaché Maria Lind, Nanette Snoep, the Cologne-based Van Joost Museum's director, who is the director of the space, which curated this very important Resist exhibition in Germany at the moment. We have the Off Biennale team, Hajnalka Somogyi, Katalin Székely. We have Vera Marusic on this team. So it's a very, it's a team that has potential to connect the topic of Roma art with institutions and to conduct an institutional criticism. And here again, the projected image called the attention of the ICOM, the museum's international associations. And we are having a discussion with the ICOM board on January 27. So we will express the aims of Roma MoMA and also the need for such a museum in Europe.
Wow, that's great. Well, you know, our podcast is focused on utopia, and ERIAC seems like it could be an integral part of that utopia. What, if you could, for you personally, what do you want ERIAC to have achieved in the next 10 years? How should it be developed by then?
ERIAC is the place where we must perform utopias, no matter how crazy something sounds. Like, okay, let's start performing this museum. We cannot wait for these majority spaces to start giving up space and privileges. We are just going to start performing it as it exists. And we start performing it, and 2 weeks later, an American couple writes me an email that they would like to buy tickets and they can't find it.
Great.
This is how you perform utopias.
Fact follows fiction.
And I think if we continue performing these utopias, ERIAC will grow, the membership will thrive, and will nurture a new generation of Roma intellectuals and artists. And this new generation of Roma intellectuals and artists will make real and true political, economic, and cultural connections to the majority. meaning that they will not be in opposition, they will be integral part in shaping the discourses, shaping the exchange, and shaping the future together.
Mm-hmm. Are there any upcoming projects you'd like to point out?
And the upcoming projects, there are so many of them that suddenly I don't even know which one to mention. We are hoping to have a conference in France this year that will be of high importance, the Conference on Resistance and Roma History. This is a year of another TISA Prize that the membership gives to an outstanding artist. Mm-hmm. A TISA Prize also means that we are coming together if the pandemic allows.
Yeah, hopefully.
And we are celebrating with one of the greatest artists. So a lot of surprises at the end of the year are ahead of us. And otherwise, diligent work of the everyday of Eriak.
Yeah. We're looking forward to what will come up next.
Yes, very much. Everybody's listening should be as excited as we are, because I think there's a lot of things that are just missing in the world, in this space, that we can enjoy. And Eriak really brings them to a lot of people. I think that's a great thing.
Yes, it's difficult as well. Everyone has needs and everyone has expectations towards Eriak. It's difficult to live up to all those expectations, and we are trying so hard, of course.
Now, maybe let's move to a slightly different theme. I'm going to ask you a question regarding what it feels like for you to be a Romani, a Romani woman. If you were asked questions about your cultural identity, what is it? How does it? What does it mean to you? Why is it important to you? How is it important to you? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I am just one of a community of amazing matriarchs. I have no other way to be than growing into an other matriarch who is giving herself to the future through educating, sharing herself, through giving from her knowledge and from her food and from her heritage to the next generations. And I see this, I know we speak of the Roma community as a very patriarchal community, and it's true that women are in a double minority position, but in our subjective stories, the role of women and their leadership and their capacities are always shining brightly. So being a Roma matriarch, growing into a Roma matriarch is very much my identity. I feel authentic very much when I speak of myself being Romni. It comes for me with my skin color, with being authentic of, you know, how people put you to this place that you're a gypsy. And you feel like you are forced into this position until the point that you inhabit it, you feel comfortable with it, and you find the treasure and the power in this. And you're able to talk back, to use a term from bell hooks. And that kind of talking back is very liberating for me. And I found in my life that it's not liberating for me, but liberating to the young people I speak to, and liberating to my colleagues, and liberating to Roma art. I feel authentic as a Romni. And I think it's impossible to live anyhow else for me. I don't know any other way of living. I can't step out of this.
Mm-hmm. I asked Bill the same question in the last recordings, because we're always talking about this cultural identity in conversations. And he said that sometimes he's really sick of being forced to think about what it means to him to be Roma, and always thinking about his cultural identity. Can you understand his exhaustions?
Yes, I can understand it. I also know this very much from the artists. Mm-hmm. You know, that sometimes it's nice to just be and not be Roma and not participate in this very complex heritage and discourse and politics. I'm not able to leave, unfortunately, any longer. Like I wake up sometimes thinking, okay, today I will dress very conservatively and I'm going to go to public official meetings and I'm going to act differently. And then I feel so unauthentic, you know, with my round little body. It's impossible for me to leave any longer from this Roma position. But I understand that it could be possible for others to desire at least to be free from it.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm sorry if I sounded, Isabel, like I was complaining that I hate this question.
No, because, not at all.
You know, but I just want to clarify. I wanted to stay as quiet as possible because I had difficulty asking this question just now. I mean, I had to ask Timea this question and I thought, well, it's a good question. It's okay to answer that every once in a while. And that's what we're doing on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But when I had to actually ask it a few seconds ago, I was thinking, oh no, how do I ask this? Mm-hmm. Oh, it sounds funny to me. I don't know how to ask it authentically as well, because I just want to pick up off of the example that Timea you just gave. Dressing conservatively. Sometimes I think I've gone to events in the past where I have to represent Roma and I'm thinking, oh no, I can't wear that shirt that has all the colors on it because I'm going to look too much like a stereotype, but I like it. It's my favorite shirt, but no, I can't wear it to this event because then I'm going to look like a stereotype. And I'm thinking, God, when it comes to Roma events, I have to dress like a gajo. And in my real life, I can dress any way I want. But when there's this extra judgment, I have to think twice now. And
I don't know if you guys heard my Cairo story, but I received a big European prize in 2008. Yeah. And I was dressed in a conservative suit and I got a present from my friend, a beautiful scarf from Romani Design. And I couldn't not wear the Romani Design scarf because the friend was also following the event. So I had the scarf on me. And then while I was going off stage, I was extremely uncomfortable. I also just had my son. I was very voluptuous, very tired. You know, I also was exhausted with this managing the household, the baby, and my career at the same time. But apart from all these struggles, at that moment, during this very fancy event, shaking hand with Christoph Stötzel and all these prize winners, very white and very, very distinguished, distinct in a way, and well-mannered, I felt somehow inferior. And then this inferiority culminated when I got stuck on stage between two of these wooden panels with my high heels, and I had to take off my shoe.
Oh, no.
And I had no other, I know it's super funny, but what happened is I had to perform this, right? Because you can't just be uncoordinated as a Roma matriarch. So I took off the shoes in an elegant way after I realized that I won't be able to get this out just by shaking my leg. So I took off the shoes and I stood there. And the part of the audience who found me there without shoes and barefooted was touched. And one of them actually cried because I stood there for like 20 seconds and I just said, thank you. And I picked up my shoes and left. But for me, that was an important lesson, you know? Mm-hmm. Like I have to embrace that feeling of feeling inferior and uncomfortable and not too enough tall and elegant and thin and, I don't know, white enough.
Yeah, many Roma emphasize traditions within Roma families and they're passed from one generation to the next. And you've mentioned your mother passing on, you know, ideas to you. Is there any other example, anything you want to say from your family experience about a Roma tradition or something that's influenced you that is kind of core to your Roma identity?
Why my mother was extremely careful with the surroundings. She has cooked Roma food, and now she has also trained my daughters to cook Roma food. So we have a lot of traditional recipes. She's also coming from a musician family, which means every Sunday we listen to these Roma prime musicians on TV doing their gypsy music, as it's called in Hungary. And as much as I hated it when I was younger, I now know the songs. And you know what happens when you know the lyrics of a song. Yeah. You're just involved. So the musician family's history is very much part of my identity and now my children's identity. And unfortunately, I didn't learn the language in my family because neither part of my family spoke Romanesque. So language I did not inherit. But gastronomy, this interestingly, this kind of glamour was also present in my life through both of my parents, a natural inclination for the glitzy and shiny and glamorous things and flamboyance.
I see that it's what Daniel Baker called the gypsy aesthetics, right? The visual sensitivity.
Exactly.
Timia, you once talked about knowledge born out of Roma cultural heritage. What is this exactly for you? Can you give us some specific examples of this knowledge that comes from cultural heritage of the Roma?
Yes, I will sound crazy, Isabel, if I start speaking about this, but we maybe risk it. I don't know. I start with a more subtle example that is scientifically actually proven, but this one is how Roma have an established knowledge about the sanitizing impact of gold and copper, and how these materials actually help water to remain clean and consumable after they are stored in these pots and canne. So if you go into traditional communities in the Balkans, in Central Europe, you will see that there's traditional blacksmiths, goldsmiths, and coppersmiths who are still making these pots. And then today, during the pandemic, we see a return of these copper and gold household utilities that are promoting antiviral qualities of these materials. If you go to Kakanj, there's a whole community of coppersmiths who are making beautiful pots and water units and cups for consuming water and milk and other products. So this is an old knowledge that is so central to the Roma knowledge that it's just obvious for us.
Oh, interesting. Some lessons for the majority of society here, right?
Yes, and I could go into these lessons about water memory and how you shouldn't drink the water that comes straight out of the pipe, but you should let it sit so that it consumes nice memories and then you drink the water. But I told you I will sound crazy when I start.
No, we don't. It's interesting.
I mentioned just two more examples.
Yeah, please go ahead.
One of them is the communication through patchworks, which was a communication method not just during the underground slave movement in the American history, but it's also a communication technique of Roma women. So patchwork as a traditional technique with embroidery is an extremely important communication technique between Roma women, and it's a historical tradition. Or I bring the example of flamenco, and then I stop with my craziness. This is an example of flamenco we know primarily as a dance form actually born out of Roma resistance. And I refer here to the words used by Bill and Anna Mirka, my colleague, and Bill Billa, who is sitting with us today. So it's a dance form born out of resistance. What we don't know about flamenco is the gitano and gitana, they use this word similar to the word that Eastern cultures use, the word of chi. It's life energy. It's everywhere in household design. It's in your breathing technique. It's in your constellation. When I hear these mindfulness trainers speaking about how to be mindful, how to fix your energy, how to breathe to fix your energy, I can't think of anything else but flamenco. And I have examples of this. Maybe one day I will write a blog about all these crazy, crazy knowledges that we know are central to Roma heritage and are used in a strange way or popularized in a strange way in our current popular cultures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of appropriation, actually. Bill, shall we play our little game?
Sure.
We're going to read some terms to you, and you answer spontaneously without thinking, with just one word or one sentence.
Okay.
Yeah? Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Art.
Future.
Knowledge.
Elders.
Resistance.
Holocaust.
Body.
Women.
Nature.
Life.
Home.
Children.
Love.
Family.
Hate.
Fascists.
Europe.
Peace.
Institutions.
Museums.
Politics.
Roma.
Dilino.
Dilino. Majority.
Bachtalo.
Joy.
Gajo.
Education.
Anti-Gypsyism.
Hatred.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. That's the end of our little game. Dilno is the Anglo-Romani word for fool or foolish. Dilino is the Central European version of the same word. It's the diminutive of the word dilo. This is originally an adjective, but can be used as a noun. And in both cases, even people who don't know Romani very well will often know this word. Buc is the Anglo-Romani word for luck. Its Central European version, bacht, means luck or happiness. Bachtalo is the adjective, means happy or lucky. It's typically used in a greeting, Teoves Bachtalo, may you be happy and lucky. Gorgio is the Anglo-Romani word for a non-Romani person. In Central European Romani, the word is gajo. In its original sense, it's not pejorative. Depending on context and tone of voice, it can be pejorative, and people not familiar with the Romani language often presume this negative meaning.
Timea, let's talk about utopia, about dreams. Let's start with a dream. If you could spend a day with an important, perhaps a well-known person of your choice, could be dead or alive, who would it be?
Very lucky person. I usually get my wishes to come true, you know? I've done this. I spent a day with Gayatri Spivak. I had the chance to do this with ERIAC, the European Roma Institute for Arts and Culture, and Bill Billa was actually a discussion partner for a...
Yes, yes, that was a very nice day. Yes,
I was in the audience at least.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yes, now I remember also, Isabel, that you were there and we were focusing on affirmative sabotage. But you didn't know that I wasn't tortured only during that conversation by Gayatri Spivak, who called me out on my really bad questions. I was tortured from the moment of her arrival to the airport the night before. My colleagues also put her into the hotel as Mrs. Spivak, and that was a nice performance of an hour of a neurotic outbreak, how we women shall have the right to be misses until we die. And that's true, too. Mm-hmm. So I had this. If I could choose someone else, it would most probably be Bell Hooks, whose books I really love. And the last one on love was very important reading for me, actually, because of my nerdiness and know-it-allness. I really have to learn a softer way of kindness and love in general.
Would you call yourself an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm a frustrated optimist.
So what do you think, as a frustrated optimist, you think that the current crisis can become starting point for changes?
If the crisis gets subversive enough to address social forms and class issues, then perhaps the crisis can be productive. Whenever I'm in Budapest, by the way, I get into a mode of apathy. There's not much we can do. and we are doomed. But I think this is just some kind of Central European nihilism that takes over me whenever I'm here. And I remain hopeful. The crisis can have productive output, but I think that we need to achieve a point of the crisis which is so deep that it really is subversive.
Mm. Yeah. In what regard can Roma serve as a model for new ways of understanding the Europe of tomorrow? What do you think the majority can learn from us?
I could answer positive statements regarding our resilience and survival, and regarding how we managed to transfer the knowledges and heritages without any support, any institutions, generations to generations. This transgenerational knowledge has created the current intelligentsia, the current leadership, which is not any longer isolated, but is one block. And this achievement is certainly one that will transform Europe. There is no turning back. And the colonial process is irreversible from this point on. What we can teach Europe is not this resilience. This is important for ourselves. This is mainly our own lesson. But what we can teach Europe is, if we will not go away, if we will not be silenced, if we will not be killed, and we stay and we grow unstoppably, and we have, even under these circumstances, managed to contribute to the ideas of Europe, is we can teach the values that Europe has obviously forgotten. Mm-hmm. The values of belonging, the values of respect, the values of solidarity, and the values of living together, you know, in peaceful cohabitance.
So you think we can help Europe to distinguish and imagine itself with Roma included in that vision?
There's no other way to go. I mean, we don't have to help. We are the only community who knows this. We have a history. We are the most peaceful minority. We haven't participated any of the major European conflicts and wars. And we have this knowledge in the core of our community. If Europe as such wants to exist, Europe will have to re-examine itself being a community. A community is based on values, and these values will have to come from a growing population, one population that can define the future, and that's Roma. Mm-hmm. For me, this is not even an utopia. This is a logic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then if it's not utopia, what would be your utopia, your dream for Europe?
Well, I'm very radical. I'm a bit afraid to say this, but I would like the United States of Europe. I would like one constitution that ensures the equality of people and ensures that we are not just an economic community, but a political, cultural, and value-based community as well.
Hmm. A federal Europe.
Hmm. Yes. That's a nice utopia.
Yeah. I don't think that's so radical. I say that all the time.
No one is listening.
That's good. That's good. I think, Bill, at a certain point, you know, it will be us and maybe a few other believers in Europe, you know, with this European flag standing somewhere.
Yeah, I think so.
Timia, one last little game, one last question to this really wonderful, exciting conversation we had. If you could ask one question on all radio stations, TV, print media in Europe for one day, what question would it be?
What question? What makes you happy at the moment? What gives you joy at the moment? Or in other terms, you know, how are you thankful?
Oh, that's good. Thank you, Timea.
Thank you. It was really a very fantastic exercise thinking together with you. Very playful and exciting. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for being our guest. It was really inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time out for us. It was great. Thank you. Romatopia is supported by the Federal Agency for Civic Education and the Council of Europe Roma and Travelers team. Idea and concept, Isabel Rabe. Romatopia is hosted and edited by Isabel Rabe and William Biela and directed by Katja Lehmann. Sound design by Selamet and Kefait Prizani. Cover motif by Daniel Baker. Production, Media Bricks Berlin 2020.